Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, November 8th, 2019. Our weekly guest on the show is Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer who joins me each and every Friday with news and insights on books and reading. Andrew and I are speaking today in the PW offices in Chelsea. Good to see you, Andrew.
Good to see you here in New York, Chris.
Glad to be with you in the office. And interesting news this week. Yet again, Andrew, the Department of Justice has stepped up to do all it can to publicize a forthcoming book on the Trump administration, this time in the form of a letter to publisher Hachette warning that the anonymous author of A Warning, set for publication on November 19th, could be breaking the law.
You just have to laugh sometimes, right?
I mean, in fact, I think you did laugh.
It's almost comical. If it wasn't so serious, the level of incompetence, bad faith coming out of our government right now. And I don't mean that as a political statement necessarily. It's just, it's a fact, right? And here I offer Exhibit A, which is the letter from the Department of Justice warning the Hachette Book Group that its planned publication of A Warning by the anonymous author in the Trump administration may violate a non-disclosure agreement. You know, he's anonymous for a reason, right? So there again, if any potential book buyers are out there, you haven't heard about this book being out there, well, here you go.
Indeed. And naturally, there are distinct echoes in the letter of a similar missive the administration sent to Macmillan officials over Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury nearly 2 years ago. But it reminds you of something else, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, that letter sent to Macmillan was a whole other level of stupid because it involved prior restraint, right? It was the president's lawyer seeking to block publication, which, of course, we generally don't do in a free society, right? And this led to Macmillan CEO John Sargent, as he put it, you know, at Book Expo, saying, wow, I'm going to sell a shitload of books here. That's a direct quote. I'm not just being foul for using foul language for no reason. But this reminds me more of the Edward Snowden book, actually, the Hachette situation. Snowden's memoir, Permanent Record, came out just a few weeks ago. And that's because in the letter to Hachette General Counsel Carol Ross and Anonymous's agents Matt Latimer and Keith Urban at Javelin, Assistant Attorney General Joe Hunt asked for representations that the author did not sign any non-disclosure agreements and that he didn't have access to any classified information in connection with government service, which, of course, is a ruse because if he's in the White House, he obviously did both of those things, right? Hunt also requests that the publisher and agents provide the government with copies of those NDAs, which, of course, is a pure fishing expedition because once they see what NDA he signed, they'll know exactly what department he's in. And it's kind of a pretty dumb move by the DOJ's office, too, because the obvious response from Hachette was that, dude, we're the publisher. We didn't sign these non-disclosure agreements. We're not party to them. And this contract, like all our contracts, actually has a warrant that the author has the ability to publish this. So not our fight here, dude. Go on. But as we saw with Snowden, the DOJ did file a suit that, you know, over the non-disclosure agreement and the lack of agency review, very similar to what's being called out here. And it named the publisher Macmillan of the Snowden book a relief defendant. So they're now seeking to block any future payments from the publisher to the author. And it certainly is possible that the DOJ could go that route here, alleging that there's a breach of an NDA and getting an injunction that would not let Hachette actually pay royalties to Anonymous. But something tells me that the money here, the future royalties anyway, is not what's really driving the book for the author. And from the publisher's perspective, hey, thanks for the publicity.
Well, speaking of Macmillan, the publisher's controversial embargo on library ebooks is now in force. And as you report this week, libraries are not taking it well. Last Friday on the show, you mentioned a handful of boycotts in place the first day of the embargo, November 1st. And over the week since, that number has swelled.
Yeah, that's right. You know, as of last week, I had confirmed only about a half dozen boycotts by the time our newsletter went out last Friday. Well, today, I can say that the number is approaching 50, and it's rising, and it includes some major library systems, and a few systems have even decided not to buy print editions of Macmillan books, and they acknowledge that, yeah, that's going to be hard, and our users may not like that, but they're with us, because we're all mad, and we're concerned. In addition, libraries are sharing strategies for how to handle the new ebook embargo. And one of the key ways they're doing this regards that single perpetual access copy that Macmillan has positioned as such an important concession. Now, librarians know full well that the purpose of the copy, of that perpetual access copy, despite what John Sargent says, is to get Macmillan titles cataloged and discoverable in their ebooks collections, and also to pile up holds and drive demand. And that's hard to do during an 8-week embargo, right? If the book's not cataloged, it's not going to be discoverable. So the easy hack that's now making the rounds from librarians is that they're all coming together and advising and agreeing not to buy that single access, perpetual access copy until the final days before the offer expires. Devilishly simple, but very clever. As our listeners may know, that single perpetual access copy is sort of reverse embargoed, right? It's only available for the first 8 weeks, and then it's gone, and then the metered copies become available. So by not buying the single copy, the perpetual access copy early, and most libraries do buy their books pre-publication, remember, librarians are doing two things. They're not piling up holds. They're not frustrating readers. They're not skewing how many copies they may need to buy later, which is very important, but they're also denying Macmillan the ability to have the benefit of visibility in their catalogs.
Macmillan CEO John Sargent traveled to Hartford, Connecticut on Monday this week, Andrew, to meet with a group of state librarians who were holding their annual national conference there. And no minds were changed when the talking ended, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. So John Sargent met with 10 librarians for about 2.5 hours, and really nothing new to report. I've reached out to as many of those librarians in the meeting as I could find. And, all I heard was that the same defense was offered by Sargent, and the same response came from librarians that this is just wrong. This is what the librarians are saying, and unjustified. You can read my story on the PW site, but the long and short of this is that the state librarians told Sargent they didn't believe him. They didn't believe that libraries were hurting publisher revenue. They didn't believe that Sargent had any data to back up his claims for the embargo, which, of course, Macmillan has refused to share, almost certainly because it involves Amazon data. And here's an interesting note, too, that when told that more boycotts were likely by these state librarians, Sargent expressed confidence that the impact of the boycotts would be offset by greater revenues from book sales, clearly Amazon sales. And that has to raise even more questions, I think, about what's really going on here. Now, remember, libraries are charged more than 4 times the consumer price for library ebooks. So I guess we would have to believe that Amazon is going to sell 4 ebooks for every lost library sale, and that they're going to also be making up for the marketing and author visits and all the other free discoverability that's offered by libraries. I mean, time will tell how this all plays out, but this just really seems, the more we hear about it, the more it seems like a huge, unnecessary fight without a big payoff for Macmillan.
And finally this week, Andrew, you were in a Manhattan courtroom when attorneys for Barnes & Noble told a judge they were prepared to make a risky move in their litigation with fired CEO Demos Parneros. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, so in terms of the publishing world writ large, this case really has very little bearing, I think, at this point, but it's really fun to watch. I mean, I feel bad for everybody that's in it, but wow, what a shocking soap opera this has turned out to be. And I can't, and I know many of our readers can't look away either. But here is the latest. At a pre-motion hearing on Monday, attorneys for Barnes & Noble told a federal judge, who's John G. Codal, that they plan to proceed with a motion for summary judgment on 2 of the 3 claims filed against the retailer by CEO Demos Parneros. The judge responded with a warning. That's a risky motion. He repeatedly said this. That is a really risky motion over and over. It was ringing in my head when I walked out of the courtroom. In the brief 20-minute conference, Codal spoke very frankly with the parties, and he told them that, hey, once I decide on this motion, the position for both parties is going to be dramatically different, for better or for worse. And, more than once over the course of the hearing, Codal suggested that the parties take this opportunity to seek mediation to try to revive settlement talks. Both sides will never be in as good a position as they are right now to resolve the case, Codal said. Whether they do or not remains to be seen. But he's absolutely right. With discovery in the case now over, both sides really know what they have. And if there's going to be a deal, now would be the time to do it.
So we will see what happens. You will watch it closely for us. But in your view, why is this a risky move?
Well, the short hearing came after Barnes & Noble attorneys last month told the court that they wanted to move for summary judgment. This judge requires pre-motion hearings before those things happen. But they wanted to try to knock out the claims of defamation and breach of good faith. And specifically, Barnes & Noble attorneys are arguing that summary judgment is warranted here because now that the discovery is done, we don't think that the facts actually support either of those counts. But that's far from clear. And, attorneys for Parneros told the judge in another letter that they remain confident that once this went to trial, that the fired CEO's bombshell claims in his suit would stand up. And they stressed that a lot of facts still remain in dispute, despite being no smoking gun in the discovery. And in that letter with the court this week, Parnaris attorney said the former CEO was obviously and clearly defamed by being fired in a memo that suggested that he was fired for some kind of sexual harassment charge. And I'm going to confess right now that when I got that memo from Barnes & Noble on July 3rd of last year, that it said he was being fired for violating company policy that wasn't financial related, my first thought was me too. So I'm sure I'm not the only reporter who thought that. So why is it risky? Because if Kotal hears the summary judgment motion and decides to let these two claims go to trial, well, it's over, right? Parnaris is going to win if that's the case. And he's getting a big payday. He's asking for more than $70 million in damages from the defamation case alone. And adding up everything else, the money he was denied from his contract, now that the company has been sold, the money he would have made there, his legal fees, it is conceivable that if he wins in a resounding fashion, that this award could top $100 million. So Barnes & Noble is also countersuing Parnaris. Let's not forget that. They're alleging that the former CEO purposely botched a potential deal for the company in 2018, and that he was guilty of abusive behavior, including a claim of sexual harassment. So all of this is going to come into whatever happens in terms of a settlement or a trial. But the stakes in this case at this point are pretty high. And, you know, whether or not this is going to go away, I'm not so sure, but we'll know more soon.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for speaking with me today here in PW's offices and every Friday on CCC's Beyond the Book.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on Beyond the Book, as the audio revolution has unfolded, audiobooks and podcasts have existed largely in worlds adjacent. With the simplicity of a major retailer for audiobooks and a major source for podcasts. But change is upon us. The recent acquisition of multiple podcast networks is creating rivals in the world of podcasts. Meanwhile, audiobook publishers are evolving beyond their signature format with the development of original works that exist in a middle ground between audiobooks longer and podcasts shorter. This coming collision of audiobooks and podcasts means more choice for consumers along with more confusion for publishers, authors, and other content producers. What's driving the change is consumer listening behavior, as Michelle Cobb of the Audio Publishers Association told me at Frankfurt Book Fair last month.
If you are an audiobook listener who listens to podcasts, you consume twice as many audiobooks as audiobook listeners who don't listen to podcasts. And we often hear the term that they are kind of gateway drugs in between each other. You start listening to podcasts, you're like, ooh, I like audio. Now I'm going to try this audiobook, and vice versa. So it's really supporting the idea of audio listening, and it's creating a younger audience as well.
When audiobooks and podcasts collide, next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.